Hello and welcome to another episode of Science Chat, the Science Communication Podcast. I'm Sean Marshall. At ESOF 2010 in Turin a year ago, Joachim Deng presented, as part of a general session on science education and scientific interest, a talk entitled Crossing Borders with Outreach Programs and Educational Networks, a Research Institute's Novel and Daring Approach to Science Education. As part of Science Chat series of looking back at ESOF 2010 in preparation for ESOF 2012, I spoke to Joachim about this presentation and asked him how the project has been going since. Joachim, welcome to Science Chat.
Hello.
Some of the biggest challenges in science education today are increasing the scientific literacy of students and promoting the scientific interest in students. Are they always linked? I mean, I know they're quite different things. And do you feel that they're always linked?
Well, it's hard to say, really. I mean, I guess what schools are usually trying to do is impart scientific literacy. But if you remember your own school time, I don't think you really pick up things if you're not interested. So you need a certain amount of interest in a topic, and interest very much depends on how things are presented, I would say. So if you, a topic is presented in a boring way, of course, interest declines. If you do it in an exciting way, people are going to be more interested, or the pupils are going to be more interested. So, yes, I would say interest is important. You need a certain amount of interest in order to reach some quality of scientific literacy.
You've worked on a practical example where you've had some success in this. What is that program and how does it work?
Well, actually we have a number of programs, but the core of it is a program that started in 2004. And the basic idea is to get pupils in contact with real scientists who work at our institute. I should be saying I'm working at the Marine Science Institute. So that's a big advantage in the sense that, well, marine science is something that's always been attractive to students or pupils. So we get a lot of pupils and teachers coming in because they're curious. And with this curiosity, we can work in the sense that we introduce them to our science topics and try to attract them to do something themselves, to become active. So what we usually offer is practical work for the students together with some of our scientists or instructors. And this can take many different formats. It depends on the number of pupils, on the time they have available, or the time the teacher specifies for that, on their interests, if they're more interested in the biological aspects of ocean sciences or the physical ones or geology, and on the framework in which the school wants to do this sort of thing. Is it something where they are going to get grades afterward, or is it something which is completely voluntary? So depending on all these factors, we put together different courses or opportunities. Usually the way things work is that a teacher will call me and either ask for his class or a group of students or maybe one single student if we have any opportunity for these students to work with us. And then I ask for their interests and the time frame they are able to work in. And then I ask our scientists if they have interesting topics and who would be around and willing to work with that group or that student. And depending on all these factors, completely different things sort of happen. So, for example, if it's a single student, very often we have requests for a thesis, which the students have to do at grades 12. And this is usually something where a single pupil will be working with one scientist for something like 12 months, where they do experiments in the lab or at sea sometimes. And at the end of those 12 months, they have to write up a thesis of about 20 or 30 pages. So that's an example of a very deep involvement of single students. On the other end of the spectrum, you can have a whole class of students, 20, 25, 30, who are only staying with us for, say, maybe 2 to 5 days during a project week, or once a week for two lessons in the afternoon for a period of a couple of weeks. And for this sort of thing, you build a completely different program. Usually what we want is that something, some product comes out of it at the end. So we don't just want to entertain the pupils, but we do want them to become active, to find out how research works for themselves, together with one of the scientists, and to produce something at the end, which not only they can show at school, but which we as a research institute can also use for our outreach work. So that could be either presentations by the pupils, or maybe posters they put together, which we can hang up at the institute, or sometimes these written theses. So this is the work we did since 2004, with pupils from grade 5 to about grade 12. Recently meaning something like 2 years ago, we started a new thing where with a different funding opportunity, we had the chance to experiment with video as a medium to attract pupils' interest. And since then, we started producing short, let's say YouTube-like video clips together with the pupils on science topics. And the challenge for the pupils there is not to do, well, basically what we are doing now, an interview with a scientist and just put it on the web or something like this, because other pupils are probably, not really excited about this kind of presentation. So what we want them to do is to wrap the science into an interesting story, present it in a different way, such that other pupils are going to say, hey, that's cool, I want to watch another one. And this initially was a big experiment for us. Would it work or would it fail completely? But by now we have something like 20 or 24 of those video clips of varying quality. And I think we're fairly confident that this works. What we don't know yet is if other pupils are actually watching those things. That's something we still have to find out.
Okay, well, that kind of takes me on to my next question, because I was wondering, how do you actually evaluate the success of these types of programs? Maybe even, you know, the earlier program, the one that you've been running since 2004.
Oh, there are different ways of evaluating. So I guess the simplest one is, what you might call evaluation by feet. Do the pupils actually return once they've worked with us? Are they likely to come back for more? And the same applies for teachers. And with that kind of response, we're fairly happy. So we find that a lot of the teachers have been staying with us for years now, and some of the students also work with us repeatedly. They may turn up at age 12 or so for a first brief contact, and they come back when they're 16 or 17 for a deeper study. So although this is not a formal evaluation, it gives you a feeling that, what you're doing is not completely beside the point. Of course, there are more formal ways of evaluation, like handing out questionnaires. And then it always depends on what exactly you want to know. Now, the thing we ultimately want to know is one that's very hard to evaluate by questionnaires, because two purposes of these programs. One of them is, are we able to attract more pupils to study sciences at university later on? And the second one is, do the pupils actually learn something while they're with us, and does this raise their interest in a way where, I don't know, months or years later, they are still interested in sciences? So do we have a lasting impact? And this is something very hard to evaluate with questionnaires, because you have to be able to get hold of the pupils months or years after they actually visited the institute. And so far, we haven't been too successful with these kinds of evaluations. We are trying, we have been trying different schemes with those, and we do see some success, but since we don't cater for huge numbers of pupils, we don't have anything that's statistically significant yet. So this is likely to still take a lot of time. What we do see is that we are beginning to encounter the first students at university who have been working with us years before while they were still at school. So this raises our optimism.
Yeah, that certainly, I think, show that there, you certainly have the ability to keep the students interested if they come back and if they do actually get to university as well, you know?
Yeah. So, for example, I asked one of the girls the other day, you're studying chemistry now. Would you have studied chemistry without our program? And she said, well, yes, actually, I always wanted to study chemistry, but originally I thought chemistry is something, once you've studied it, you go to industry and you create, I don't know, a new type of plastic or something commercial. And I never realized yet that you could also do it in environmental sciences and apply it to all sorts of other things. So this is something she learned with us, and she's now actually heading in new directions than she was originally intending to go. So I think that's a good, proof of concept.
Of course, yeah. And are the programs fully funded by the Institute? Or do you have private funding as well?
Actually, we've mostly been living on private funding so far. We just used the Institute's resources as a backup in case we run out of money. So we were fortunate in that originally we were funded by a foundation for 5 years or so, but not with huge amounts of money. But it was good to have a formal funding, because in the eyes of the scientists at the Institute, this gave us the status of a real project rather than just a, you know, hobby sort of thing which you can do or leave. So scientists are used to thinking in terms of projects where deliverables are something they have to strive for. And since we were able to tell the scientists, look, this is a project and we have to deliver, they were quite willing to help us along and to join in.
Okay, you mentioned earlier on that in the project that you've had running since 2004, that sometimes you have classes of up to 25 students. How easy is it to cater for these relatively large numbers and to ensure that the quality of the program is kept to a high standard?
It's not that easy. It depends on the kind of program you do. So, for example, since we really want the students to work on a problem, so not just listen to a talk and go away, but go into the lab and do some measurements, actually experience that you have to do many measurements before you get good results. You have to have a lot of staff to work with these pupils. So it's a fairly personnel intensive kind of work, which you can't spread to huge numbers in this way. So that's why this thing I mentioned earlier on becomes an important point. We need the students to produce some sort of product which they can show to other students and which we can show to other students in order to get some sort of multiplication effect. So at the level where we work very intensively with the pupils, we don't cater for large numbers, but we try to multiply that by showing the products to a larger community.
And it's been said that students lose interest in pursuing scientific studies because they perceive a lack of jobs in the area. Even if this is the case, how important do you think it is to increase the scientific literacy of students, even for students who may not continue on in the scientific field and may not decide to pursue a scientific study in university?
Well, 2 points. The first one, I think this question of job opportunities. I talked to a lot of people in different countries, and it's quite interesting that in some countries this is an important aspect. So pupils are saying, I'm not going to study sciences because you won't find jobs afterwards. In Germany, we don't seem to have that problem that much. Here, it's a different thing. Students don't want to enter sciences because they think they're generally difficult, but they don't ask for job opportunities in their decision to go to university for sciences or not. Nevertheless, I think it's tremendously important to have scientifically literate citizens, because basically the world nowadays works on all sorts of science and technology. And if you want to do an informed decision or join the discussion or know what's going on, you should be able to at least have a grasp of how science works, how science argues. So, for example, journalists always expect our scientists to answer their questions with a definite yes or no or black or white. And what the scientists instead do is they always say, well, with a high level of confidence, we think that this kind of statement. Now, this is something that very often journalists don't appreciate because they don't know how a scientist thinks. So I think it's very important that students at some point experience how science works in order to be able to come to grips with this kind of statement and to understand why you can't just give a black or white answer in many things. Or other things like, for example, the whole discussion recently about Fukushima. Of course, atomic energy or gene manipulation, all these topics require a basic understanding of sciences, which I think we can't really live without nowadays.
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing that I find very interesting. It's one thing dealing with students who are potential scientists of the future, but I think it's very important when we stop considering them as potential scientists, but start to consider them just as future adults who need to have a certain amount of scientific knowledge just to be able to make those informed decisions, as you said. And do you think that scientific literacy of adults is at a high level in Germany, or what do you think about the situation in Europe as a whole?
Hard to say. I mean, if you just consider yourself or me, I think we tend to look at many things in terms of black boxes. We're quite willing to assume that our cell phone just works, although we're not quite sure what happens inside. The same applies to cars or all sorts of other things, which is fine for some things, but, well, in some areas you need to take informed decisions, like, for example, the whole discussion about climate change. Initially, people were all worried about climate change. Then suddenly, in the media, there was a lot of criticism about the scientific methods that were being used, and the scientists were being criticized of, you know, forging data and doing all sorts of weird things. And now this has been cleared up, but it took a lot of arguments. So I think in some topics we shouldn't be happy with a state where we just assume that we have a technological or scientific black box and somebody will know how it works. But we should actually strive for a little bit of deeper understanding and also support the students in, well, not necessarily indoctrinating them or telling them how things work, but more support them in learning how to find out themselves how to obtain this information, because the information is there on the web and everywhere, but you have to know how to find it and you have to know how to judge it.
But it's very difficult, isn't it, to achieve a high enough level of, if you like, scientific understanding or understanding of the scientific process, specifically for an example like climate change, as you said, because the media is so happy to jump on either side or both sides and present a very, very, if you like, engaging case for whichever side they've taken. So, I mean, in some of those situations, you would need quite a high level of scientific literacy to be actually able to find your way through what they're actually saying to find the actual truth of what has happened or what is going on.
Yes, well, you can't expect everybody to go into all the details of every scientific topic that's around on the planet. But as I said, I think in terms of scientific literacy, for me, scientific literacy is something where you learn that how the scientific process works, and you get some understanding on what's involved. So, for example, you learn that you need to do experiments, and the experiments have to be verifiable. They have to be repeatable. So it's not just one experiment that demonstrates something, and if it doesn't work the second time, it's still a good experiment. No, it has to be repeatable, and you have to be able to demonstrate that it works. You have to know a little bit about statistics, and why is a 90% confidence pretty good compared to, say, somebody just saying, I believe that. So without having to go into all the details, some basic gut feeling, what science is about and how science works is something I think we should strive for.
And do you think that it's something that should be included in school curriculums instead of, I mean, it's great when you know, present this podcast, when I get a chance to talk to people who have provided programs like these. But sometimes it frustrates me that, you know, that governments and the people in the countries who are responsible for education can't see that, that sometimes it's more important for students, say, from the age of 12 or 13, to actually learn about the scientific method and not to be so caught up in just learning a list of scientific facts. And you think, I mean, I think it's something that should be on the school curriculum. What do you think?
Definitely. So, in fact, the programs we are running are sort of, patching this kind of problem in the current school system. So we shouldn't need to do that, because in an ideal world, the schools should be doing this. But we're not living in an ideal world, unfortunately. And teachers are overstressed. They don't have enough funding usually. And very often their science teaching or their own learning about science is 20 or 30 years old when they were at university. So this is why we as a research institute, and of course many other institutions and organizations, try to patch the system at these points to impart a little bit more fascination and excitement to the students about sciences and give them this first-hand experience of sciences, which they don't often get at school.
Yes, I agree. And on that note, I'd like to thank you very much, Joachim, for coming and talking to Science Chat today.
You're welcome.
Well, that's it for another episode of Science Chat. You can find out more about ESOF 2012 on their website, www.dublinscience2012.ie, and you can find out more about Joachim's projects and have a look at the videos on sfb-outreach.ifm-geomar.de. And as usual, you can find out more about this episode and other episodes at www.sciencechat.net/WordPress.